from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1798, Thomas Malthus warned of epidemics, pestilence, and plagues if humans didn't rein in their population growth. Many billions later, we're still growing. 7.2 billion now, headed for 11, we're told, with consequences all over. Two views with us today. One says, dial it back fast or nature will do it for us and it won't be pretty. The other says, slow population growth and risk seeing your nation fail. This hour on Point, the population of the planet. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will we ever rein it in globally? And what does reining it in mean nationally? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Seattle is Alan Wiseman, journalist and best-selling author of The World Without Us. His new book, Thinking About a Human Population of Maybe 2 Billion and How to Get There, is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan Wiseman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Very nice to have you with us. And joining us from Washington is Stephen Philip Kramer, professor of grand strategy at the National Defense University in Washington, author of a forthcoming book warning of falling national populations. It is The Other Population Crisis, What Governments Can Do About Falling Birth Rates. Stephen Philip Kramer, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to have both of you with us. We're going to look at this from a couple of angles here. I'm not sure they're mutually exclusive, but maybe we'll see. Alan Wiseman, first to you. We've got people writing in already saying, hey, 7 billion, of course it's too many. And others saying, Malthus warned way back when we couldn't keep it up. And here we have. What's the problem? How are you looking at the gallop that we're on, Alan?
Well, you know, Malthus made his warning back before we were over a billion. And then the very same year, Edward Jenner created a vaccine for smallpox. And that was followed quickly by other vaccines and by eradication of insects that carried epidemics, pasteurization of milk. And suddenly fewer people were dying in infancy. It used to be that most babies didn't make it to their fifth birthday. And people were living longer, so our numbers went up. And then in the 20th century, we did two things to greatly increase the amount of food on the planet. One is that we invented a way to pull nitrogen out of the air and chemically apply it to our soils. And then in the mid-60s, we did what many people say refutes Malthus and refutes Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, mm-hmm. warning of huge famines during the 1970s. And that was the Green Revolution, came up with ways to create to grow far more grain per plant. And that doubled harvests and in some places increased them tenfold. But to say that the Green Revolution solved everything is only giving part of the story.
You're writing now that the only answer here is for humans themselves to dial back the human population, or you write, nature will do it for us. So what are you suggesting, Alan? Dial it back how and to what kind of target?
Well, you know, to research Countdown, I traveled all over the world. I went to 21 countries. And one of the reasons for that was not just to find compelling stories to put sort of a human face on this question, but also to see if there's anything in the cultures, the histories, the liturgies of a wide swath of the world's cultures that might make it palatable or even desirable to have fewer children in certain times of need. The first thing that everybody thinks of for this question is the Chinese one-child policy. Mm-hmm. And not many people like that at all. You know, they find it coercive, draconian, people getting into your bedroom and telling you what to do. And, you know, most Chinese don't like it very much. But it turns out I found all kinds of other ways that countries have managed to bring their population in check, or the people in those countries have. And my ultimate conclusion was that a government telling you what to do is never going to work. However, you can make it very, very attractive to people to have a reasonable amount of children that is both sustainable for their economy and ultimately sustainable for our planet. You know, it's technology that we already have, contraception, as opposed to trying to come up with new ways to mass produce zero emission energy, which, you know, we simply don't have that yet. And even if we did, the uptake would be very slow. And even if we did take it all up, that still wouldn't solve the fact that so many of us need food. We're dedicating 40% of the planet now to feeding ourselves, either cultivation or grazing. And I actually go to the Green Revolution centers in this book, the one for improvement of corn and wheat in Mexico and the one for rice improvement in the Philippines. And I talk to the scientists about what's the chances of us technologically stretching the food supply like they did back in the 1960s. And those chances are actually rather slim.
You say aim for 2 billion. That sounds like a tall order. We'll dig into that. The United Nations is projecting we may be headed for 11 billion. If we go to 11 billion, what consequences, Alan?
Well, first of all, I don't think that we're going to get there. I think that already we're bursting the seams of this planet. And the best example is that we're all addicted to energy. You know, even the humblest among us are you know, burning firewood, they need food, they need materials for shelter. And we're overloading our atmosphere with, you know, you might call it insulation. We're holding the heat in, and then that hot atmosphere is being absorbed by the sea, which expands and rises, and its chemical composition changes. I know, you know, I'm in Seattle today, and the oyster farmers are very concerned about what's happening to the shells of oyster larvae as the chemical composition moves more towards the acidic level of the pH scale. So there are multiple problems, water shortages particularly, and the fact that our harvests are going to drop by 10% of our major grains with every 1 degree centigrade of average warming. And those are figures that have been corroborated by many, many scientists.
So nature will do what in that case, Alan? If nature will do it for us, meaning?
Well, it's going to start out with resource wars. We're going to be fighting each other, and that already happens. I start this book in Israel and Palestine. You've got two populations that are trying to be the majority in a land, much of which is a sandbox. That water war, in a sense, has been going on since Genesis. But today, it's really crucial. A lot of people can't figure out why Israel insists on holding on to West Bank settlements. But of course, they're on top of the mountain aquifer in Israel and Palestine. Most of it runs through the West Bank.
War potentially, but that's not all.
There's war potentially. There's going to be shortages of food. I've already seen them happen. I go to Niger, which is a Sahel nation, and the farmers all told me that their 10-degree drought cycle and turned into a 10-year drought cycle turned into a 5-year drought cycle, and then a 3-year drought cycle, which hadn't ended for 3 years when I was there. And every village was losing 150 to 200 kids. Cattle were dying, and their millet wasn't growing. And these are changes that are only being exacerbated now. They're not getting any easier. Again, in the Green Revolution centers, they told me that if we keep growing the way that we are, they're going to have to create as much food in the next 50 years as has been consumed in all of human history.
Alan Weisman, hold the thought right there. That's a pretty shocking idea. Let that sink in, and I'll turn to Stephen Philip Kramer. Stephen, you're talking about another angle on this. Your book upcoming is The Other Population Crisis, and you say that for individual nations, it's not overpopulation but underpopulation that may create what you call a new demographic threat to national security. How so, Stephen?
Well, I think there are two processes that are going on. One is what Alan is talking about, overpopulation, which is especially the case in many countries of the world, sub-Saharan Africa and, you know, parts of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But in a very large part of the world, almost all developed societies and many less developed societies, you have a significant fall in birth rates, a fall that's so significant that essentially populations will begin to go down or already going down in certain countries.
Japan, Italy, Japan, more.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, how can you have two things that are so different? I think it makes sense to see them as part of a broader phenomena called the demographic transition. And I think that's the key concept. You know, 200 years ago, the whole world had high birth rates and high mortality. And then in Europe, you have a beginning of a transition whereby sanitation and health conditions improved and food supply increased. And suddenly you had lots of children who survived, whereas before they didn't. Mm-hmm. You have many, many more people. And that that led to serious problems. It led to a lot of immigration, like to the Americas and to Australia. It led, of course, many of these people were absorbed in industrialization. And eventually, as people realized that this was going on, they had fewer children. And the population of Europe began to stabilize.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound of Beijing, subway line number one at rush hour there. Of course, look at rush hour anywhere in the world these days almost, and you've got a lot of humans. We're talking this hour about the new population, global population conversation. What's too many humans on this planet? And what about countries with too few? Alan Wiseman is with us. His new book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. And he's saying, let's rein it in. We can actively do that. It's easier than figuring out how to live with a lighter footprint. Well, we'll see. Stephen Philip Kramer is with us. His forthcoming book is The Other Population Crisis, what governments can do about falling birth rates. You can join us this hour. We're headed for 10 billion plus, we're told. Can the planet handle that? Will we, could we rein it in purposefully, actively? Can you picture a planet with just 2 billion people again? And what about countries with too few people to keep things going? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Lots of response online already, and I'll put it to both of you. But Jesse says, the Earth could handle 7 billion or more if we all live sustainably. The problem is, to your point, Alan, we don't. So far, quite true. Laura says, yes, 7 billion's too many. We must end the stigma of birth control, encourage family planning, and if that doesn't work, put saltpeter in the water supply. I don't know exactly what that would do. Maybe you do, Alan, but it sounds like fewer births. Citizen James, to your point, Stephen, says, let the next Nobel Prize for Economics be awarded to the scientist who figures out how to grow an economy with a declining population. And Scott says, no worries. The inevitable zombie apocalypse will clean things up. Stephen Philip Kramer, please outline the threats to national security that you see in falling populations, where that's happening or will.
Well, if you have a declining population, it makes it even more difficult to deal with some basic problems like pensions and retirement. We already have a problem of doing it in the United States despite a relatively good population growth. What happens when you have more and more old people and fewer young people in the workforce? Who supports old people? How does that system continue? And that's a problem all over the industrialized world. Second thing is that what happens about technological innovation? Who is going to be, who are the people who are going to be producing new ideas? Are they going to be older people or younger people? Historically, it's younger people, and there are going to be fewer of them. And then you have an imbalance globally, because what's happening is there are many parts of the world where population is increasing very, very rapidly. You know, and I agree completely that it should be reined in. But then you have other places like the United States, Europe in particular, and now China, where birth rates are low or going to fall. The imbalance between the fast-growing places, which are mostly poor, and the old industrialized nations becomes a serious problem. Do you have mass immigration? Is that really possible? Look at what's happening in Europe today. 25% of the population is going to may vote for extreme right-wing parties because they oppose immigration. So immigration doesn't necessarily solve the problems of global imbalance.
Alan Weisman, jump in here for a second. And Stephen, I'll come to you again just shortly here. But Alan, you look at Nigeria and you say it's going to be have more people than China. I forget at what point, but at some point in the next century, we see where there's growth and where there's less. You know, listeners are tuned in very closely here. Fun Bobby writes to us, says overpopulation, he writes, Alan, is a racist myth. Compare the population density in any quote-unquote overpopulated African country with that of Massachusetts.
Well, there's no question that in the history of population issues that racism has reared its ugly head. The eugenics movement was closely associated with, quote, population control, unquote, right up to World War II. It was taught at Harvard and, you know, all the universities in the United States and in Europe. And I think that Hitler taught us a lesson about that. And I hope that lesson has been learned. There are humane ways to help people, you know, decide for themselves how many children they want by giving them the access to contraception. And if that access to contraception is combined with female education, I mean, that's the best contraceptive of all. You know, a girl who studies will defer her childbearing until it's over, and then she's going to have something interesting and useful to do and economically helpful to the family that she wants to raise. But you can't do that usually with seven kids hanging on you. And most educated young women stop at two or fewer.
So are you suggesting seriously that the combination of contraception and educating more females globally could actually put the brakes on this human population growth and turn it around, even take us down to the kind of 2 billion territory that comes up in your book?
Well, you know, the 2 billion figure is something that we would gradually work toward over time. I don't suggest that suddenly we abruptly do this because, as I think Stephen would agree, that would be jarring to our economy if suddenly we try to go to a new kind of prosperity that doesn't depend on constant growth. And I talked to a lot of economists in this book, including one in Japan, who sees the shrinking population of Japan as, inevitability and therefore something that could be viewed as an opportunity to really change the idea of what prosperity is. I wanted to mention something about security because on the one hand, I agree with Stephen. You know, the security issue is crucial. But also, Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong. I believe you teach at the Dwight D. Eisenhower School at the National Defense University.
And right.
In 1958, Dwight D. Eisenhower identified population growth as the biggest security issue in the post-war. And he appointed Major General William Draper, who was also an investment banker, to study the issue. And Draper ended up spending the rest of his life founding population groups. They were very concerned. And for this book, when I went to Pakistan, I really got a taste of what national security is about, or world security. I mean, Pakistan's got between 185 and 190 million people in a country the size of Texas, which only has 26 million. And by the middle of the century, they're going to have way more than the United States has right now. They can't possibly employ them all. So you have a bunch of frustrated, angry young men who then, you know, cause a lot of destabilization and security problems in our planet. But I also found examples of countries that turned that around because they didn't want to turn into Pakistan. You know, after its Islamic Revolution, Iran was attacked by Saddam Hussein. So the Ayatollah asked all the women who could to get pregnant to help build a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders.
Iraq.
8 years later, when the war ended, you know, they had this big bubble. So they implemented a program which was completely voluntary. The only thing that was compulsory was premarital classes, in which, among other things, you learn how much it costs to raise, feed, clothe, and educate a kid. They encouraged women to stay in school. They made contraception available for free and issued a fatwa saying that even a vasectomy or tubal ligation was permissible if wisdom says you've got enough kids. And they got back down to replacement rate actually a year faster than China, and it was totally voluntary.
How are you thinking about this, Stephen? If you empower women and encourage gender equality, I think you can solve both sides of the problem. First of all, what Alan is talking about is absolutely crucial. If you, in countries with very high overpopulation, giving women the means to decide on how many children they want, and the education to make that possible is probably the best way of reducing the birth rate. But the same thing also applies to countries with very low birth rates, excessively low birth rates. The problem is, in many nations, that women and children are not taken care of. They're not given the opportunity to both work and be mothers. In countries where that is made possible, birth rates are relatively stable, like in France and Sweden. What Sweden, for example, has done is given wonderful conditions for women to be both mothers and to work. A year of maternity leave, a fantastic preschool system that begins at the age one. Women who, when after a year, women can return to their jobs. They must be given the right to go back to their job, and they can work full-time or part-time. The stress that we have in this country and many other places about combining being a mother and being a worker is pretty much eliminated in Sweden. And so the birth rate is more or less acceptable. The same thing is in France. France has done a fantastic job of that as well.
And when you say acceptable, you mean higher, because what you're worried about, while Alan worries about super high birth rates, you're worried about super low birth rates like Singapore, Taiwan, most of Europe now.
Yeah, you want birth rates, I think, to converge to a kind of golden mean, more or less a birth rate that will be a sustainable birth rate. I think that that's what you're really talking about. The problem is that all by itself, it doesn't happen. You know, birth rates are not self-regulating. When birth rates in the West began to go down, which was a good thing, they fell very low in many countries, and they're not going to go back all by themselves. And you have a danger of a country like Italy, where, in 30 or 40 years, the population may go down by 50%. You'll have as many 80-year-olds, you have, young girls. This is sort of not an acceptable kind of situation. It's not what you want.
What about our listener who says this is a racial way of looking at it? I mean, Alan paints a picture where Africa will be the huge driver of population growth in this century, but our listener is kind of saying, hey, so what? You know, Europe was a huge part of the population before, 30-plus percent at one point, Europe and North America. Now that's headed for 12%. Africa's growing. Okay, so what, Stephen?
Well, African population, the birth rate will begin to go down. There's no question about that. The question is what damage is left to Africa before that happens. I mean, it's not a question of being racial or racialist. It's a question of whether these countries can support themselves, whether people can live well, whether people can be happy. I mean, having overpopulation is not a great thing for anybody. And so it's really in their interest that their population, their birth rate go down.
And I agree with Stephen on this count. You know, it doesn't really matter where the population is rising. Every human being is contributing to the stress on an overstretched planet now in, just their basic needs. And I spent time in two African nations that have severe overpopulation problems, Niger I mentioned before, and Uganda. And
Niger has the biggest birth rate in the world. Was it seven?
Between seven and eight kids per family.
Yeah.
And, they are absolutely incapable of producing enough sustenance for everybody, and it's starting to get – really, really dangerous in both places. So what happens? Either we see mass starvation or we see mass migration. Now, personally, I don't have much of a problem with migration. You know, my dad was an immigrant to the United States, and I grew up believing that the cultural richness and creativity of the United States comes from successive waves of immigrant. And I personally don't care what race or what color they are, because I think things just improve. And I also know, because I talk to so many of them, that young immigrants to the United States, young Muslim immigrants to the UK, for example, where I spent some time. They may come from some family of eight kids back in Bangladesh, but once they have the opportunity for a British education, these young girls don't want to have huge families. They want to have a couple kids. You know, they want to be mothers. I think that the problem always will come back into some kind of balance. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to be easy. I mean, the UK is an island nation. It's already straining greatly. And what Stephen said about the far-right reaction against the migrants is absolutely true. I started out my British chapter with one of the heads of the British National Party, whose grandfather or great-great-grandfather was one of the founders of the Industrial Revolution. And now he turns around and he can't figure out why he's been outcompeted by all these foreigners who've come in. Makes him really upset. And these are strains that we are going to have to adjust to. We've been doing it in the United States forever with, you know, various iterations of the Bracero program from Mexico.
Ellen Wiseman, stand by right there if you'd be kind enough. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. So you want people to rein it in, but you found plenty of attitudes out there. I mean, you talk about Niger. You're talking with the imam there who said, "We know the future is alarming," he told you, "but man cannot hold back doomsday." You went to a mother of eight in Israel, and she tells you, you know, God made the problem and he will solve it. Where's the human readiness to say, uh-oh, we've got to stop reproducing so much?
Well, let's go back to that imam, because an hour later I was with another imam who pulled out chapter and verse from the Quran where it shows that Muhammad is very, very clear about the responsibility to space children, so each child is guaranteed 2 years of mother's milk, and to be a good steward of the earth. There are surahs, verses in the Quran, just as they are in the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, saying that this is a gift of God's, and if we destroy it, we're the ones who are going to be destroyed. And that second imam was the brother of the first imam. Look, we're very used to people in our own country and all cultures interpreting religion for their own particular needs. But there are ample places in everyone's liturgy. I mean, look at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were all polygamists for the same reason the Mormons were later. You know, it was a strategy to have an awful lot of kids. But then Joseph, who was one of Jacob's 13 children, a very observant guy, he realized that the world was entering a cycle of scarcity. He only has one wife, two kids, and he counsels the Israelites and the Pharaoh of Egypt to conserve. You know, there is a time, as Ecclesiastes says, for refraining from embracing so much.
Stephen, if I may, is it possible? Do you see what Alan sees, a way to have the low growth or no growth or falling population and hold things together?
Well, I think that we fundamentally agree. The world cannot support an infinite, you know, population. And I think that climate change is the most dramatic demonstration of that, even more than the problem of food supply, because you can't continue to increase the amount of carbon in the of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and maintain a habitable planet. So we do have to have a population that begins to stabilize.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Sound of a busy Nigerian market there. Nigeria, where the population may come to exceed China's in this century. United Nations saying we could be headed for a population of 11 billion. by early in the next century. We're talking about that today, plus the warning that some countries are going to fall too low and it just won't work. Stephen Philip Kramer takes that tack in his forthcoming book, The Other Population Crisis, What Governments Can Do About Falling Birth Rates. Alan Wiseman says, let's have them fall globally or we're in trouble. His new book is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan, Stephen, listeners have been waiting patiently here. Let me turn to them. Eric in New Britain, Connecticut. Eric, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. This is a great conversation. And the question that I want to ask is, what quality of life are we looking at for citizens of this planet when we get up to 10 billion people, 9 billion people, or even today? Here in America, we live a pretty good lifestyle. We live a first world lifestyle. That's not the reality for most people across the globe. And, you know, we point out the trends that population is declining slowly in the first world countries, and not to be rough, but these are the countries with economic innovation, these are the countries that come up with new technologies, and populations are growing exponentially in parts of the world that really, I mean, don't contribute, and I don't mean to sound racist, because that's not it. It's simply a matter of where do the citizens of this planet, the people that live in Africa, the people that live in South America, that live in the uneducated, you know, poor parts of the world, what kind of lifestyle are we looking at for citizens of this planet as we get into these astrologically large numbers?
Eric, I'll put it to both my guests. Stephen Philip Kramer, first to you, because this is turf on which you get nervous. I know you're not speaking for the National Defense University there, but you are a grand strategist there. And that kind of growth where infrastructure for education and development are not so prevalent is something that has got your attention and concern here.
Well, I think that most people all over the world are pretty smart. And given the opportunity and the means to decide on their future, they will make good decisions. And people in these countries with overpopulation, I think, are going to be making the calculation that they need to limit the size of their family, just like the same thing happening in Europe and much of Asia before.
That seems entirely at odds with the numbers that Alan Wiseman reports. Niger, top of the world, 7 kids per couple. Somalia, I mean,
Because it takes time. It takes usually several generations before people begin to realize that, you know, that birth rates are high and their children are living and there are too many children. It took a long time in Europe and took time in Asia. That's where the problem lies. Before people come to that recognition, you're going to have just a huge growth of population. And that's why it would be useful if, you know, we all made an effort to provide the assistance necessary. The United States has done it sometimes, and then it's stopped because of politics in this
country. I've got to tell you, I hope for that. Who doesn't hope for that? But it sounds like dreaming.
Well, you know, the population will stabilize, and it eventually will begin to go down. But the damage may be done. And I think Alan's points there are absolutely true. You reach a point where the total population may become unsustainable. And that may well happen.
Tom in Framingham. Tom, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'd like to cite an important statistic from 1965. The source is Philip Ainslie, a UN demographer, speaking at a conference at the University of Pennsylvania on India and population growth. And what he said at the time was that the per capita increase in population per annum was 2.5% at that point in time. And if you hold that constant, it would take a mere 400 years to occupy all available land space, everybody having one person in front of them, behind them, and to the side. And 10 years hence, to have someone standing on everyone's head.
Okay, we're ingenious, but you don't really think we're ever going to get to that point, or do you, that we're going to be stacked on top of each other in every square foot?
I haven't been keeping track of the per capita increase in population, but what it does cite is a time limit and a statistical average that we should be keeping track of. And if it ever gets there, I mean, that's statistically what it says.
Tom, we've got it. Alan, are we hitting those limits right now in such a way that they're turning population growth around, sort of nature's bite back? Or I guess not. The UN is projecting. You don't agree that we're going to get there, but they're projecting 9 billion, 10 billion, 11 billion.
Well, you know, to go back to the example of Niger, they're 15 million people right now, or 16 million, and they're slated to triple by the middle of this century, even before, actually. And it's completely impossible that they're going to be able to do that. And the Nigerians that I spoke to when I was there are starting to notice that their lives have changed. The amount of available water has changed. So I'm hoping that that seeps in, because we don't have a lot of time. You know, Stephen talked about it taking generations sometimes for a gradual demographic transition. But with the way that our ecosystem is changing, I mean, we haven't had this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since 3 million years ago, when seas were between 60 and 100 feet higher. And this is going to be very problematic. I mean, just think of all the rice that's grown at sea level. We're not going to be able to build dikes to hold back the sea from flooding, or saline intrusion destroying the wells, which I saw in several countries that I went to.
Already, including Egypt and the Nile Basin, where so much is grown. I mean, you convey this with this kind of equanimity that I want to ask about, Alan, because others are writing about it with sort of horror. Stephen Emmett's book, 10 Billion. I mean, you've got a solution. You say, let's bring down our rate of reproduction and rein it in. But he sees just a horror show on this planet coming.
Well, because I think, again, this is something that we can do. We already have the technology. We have the acceptance. The majority of people in the world, the majority of women, would love to have contraception. In my book, I describe the new male contraceptives that are coming online. And it's not expensive. Right now, worldwide, we're spending about $4 billion on contraception. If we doubled that, it's just slightly over $8 billion per year. I mean, that's less than what we were spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan. We would be able to provide everyone who wanted a contraception. I mean, this is something that is actually doable. And because I found so many examples of people choosing to do it, I became very encouraged as I researched this book. But I want to speak to a couple of points that Stephen brought up. Mm-hmm. The crucial one of, in a transition to a smaller population, you're going to have fewer young people taking care of more old people. How are we going to do that? Well, I join him in, congratulating France and Sweden for the way that they have set up, daycare systems to allow working women to have the number of children that they want. But that's not cheap.
Yeah, and who's going to pay for that while you pay for all the elders at the same time on Social Security?
Well, I mean, this is a point. Once again, I can think of a lot of things that your government and mine has wasted money on in the past few decades.
Yes.
That for a generation or so, until a large populace, older generation dies off, and then the younger and old generations start to even out. If we have to take care of senior citizens for a while, that to me is a good expenditure of money. I don't believe that Italy and Japan are going to disappear. I mean, when I was in Japan, there was an institute, a bunch of statisticians proved that in the year 3000, the last Japanese baby would be born.
Well, I mean, you report the Japanese, but they've lost enthusiasm for the whole sort of reproduction thing. I mean, kind of amazing statistics in your book on how Japanese have even sort of turned off on sex. Not interested. What's going on with that?
It's an odd cultural phenomenon that's happening right now, and I'm not sure that I can explain it. I only describe it, or I let Japanese women describe it to me in the book. But Japan and Japanese will not stop having children. They're going to find a level that's comfortable, and they will keep having them. And
The Japan Family Planning Association did a survey. 36% of males 16 to 19 had no interest in sex or even despised it. 59% of female respondents said they were uninterested or averse to sex. 40% of married people in Japan said they hadn't had sex in the past month. I mean, still, Stephen Philip Kramer, you describe this as a kind of disaster scenario in the population drop category.
Well, yes, and what we're talking about here about attitudes towards sex are pretty difficult to understand. But, I mean, I don't think that the rapid decline of population in a country like Japan or Italy is a good thing, because it's going to be very difficult for those countries to function. What happens to the vast infrastructure they've built up with a much smaller population, for example? The problems can be solved, and you can achieve probably the same kind of birth rate as in a country like France or Italy, which would not be a problem in terms of global population.
More or less replacement rate.
Yeah. You have to address the problems of gender equality, giving Japanese women the opportunity to both work and have children. At the moment, if you're a professional in Japan, a woman, and you have a baby, you will never again have a chance for a real job. I mean, you choose between a baby and profession. And that kind of thing is really, you know, impossible to do.
So there you're looking to keep the birth rate strong. Alan Wiseman looking to reel the birth rate in. Let me go to Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So many good points have already been made, and I would just like to talk about solutions. Mm-hmm. First of all, I think we have to just think globally. We already do about economics, but we need to think about the fact that we're all in the same boat. So what affects the poorest nations is also going to ultimately affect everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that can happen is that the media, the churches, and the schools, in other words, the influence makers in our society, need to stop praising huge families and start talking regularly about the effects of this huge population. Because attitudes can change when those organizations focus on something, just like they changed about dental health and about drugs and all kinds of other things. Second, since we know that education, especially for women, leads to lower birth rates, and when people have access to contraception and health facilities, we have a lower population but a healthier population and a better civil society, I think we need to put more of our foreign aid dollars, and we only spend about 1% of the United States income for foreign aid. So we need to put more of that into the programs for health, education, and even microfinance, which brings millions of poor people out of poverty every year. So if we would focus more of our foreign aid on those kinds of programs, those multinational funds where other developed countries also put some money in, instead of feeling like we've got to have the biggest military in the world, you know, we've got billions of dollars going into the military.
Elaine, we've got it, and I hear what you would do with it. At the same time, we're talking about already have spent a whole lot of money, let's say, to build a wall on our southern border. That's expensive, too. Lots of cross pressures here. But you say change attitudes, spend for development, maybe we'll be okay. Donna in Fort Royal, Virginia. Donna, you're on the air.
Thank you so much. I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, but last couple weeks ago, I made a new bumper sticker. I'm all the time making them, and it's got stop right in the middle of it. And on the left side, it says, only you can stop population pollution. It just came into my brain. I don't know where.
Population pollution. Well, that's us you're talking about, but I guess there's such a thing as just too much. Alan, you talk about attitudes being open to putting the brakes on, and yet, you know, it's hard to see that everybody's going to have a global view of this. For an awful lot of people in the world, it's a matter of their family, their survival, their tradition.
Well, I'm not saying that people shouldn't have families. In fact, if they want to have
I don't mean that. I mean the size.
But if people want to have large families, there's every opportunity to do that. Because one resource that we're not running out of is children who need a home. You can adopt if you want to have more than two, which would be, you know, a husband and wife basically replacing themselves. And some people will choose to have fewer than two. And I think that you know, a healthy distribution between one and two, or some people don't even want any, is going to help over the next generation or two bring us down to a sustainable size, because we simply can't keep growing the way we're growing. And you know, a point that Stephen made before is that if we have fewer young people, who are going to be our innovators? You know, I hear that a lot. You know, well, you know, if you don't have a child, could have been the next Mozart. And, you know, when Mozart was born, there were, you know, barely a half a billion people on the planet. Same with Shakespeare. We had a critical mass of creativity in this world before the 19th century. And, you know, our innovations in the 19th century, you know, came from a smaller population. You know, the 2 billion figure, that's some scientists have calculated. What could we do if everybody had a reasonable chance at, say, something like a European lifestyle? They weren't, you know, not as energy intensive as here in the United States, but not as desperate as in Africa or South Asia. And given carbon contributions and resources and the amount of land that we dedicate to food, we could be working our way down towards a number like that. But, you know, maybe we'll stop a little higher. You know, nitrogen fertilizer has had its downside, but 40% of us wouldn't be alive without it. So you phase that out over the next few years and we could come down to something healthy.
Well, here we are sitting in a place and time where we can still talk about it with some equanimity. But these numbers just keep marching in both directions, as you say, and I am sure we're going to have many more big conversations in this century about exactly this issue. You both take big beads on it, and we're grateful for that. Stephen Philip Kramer's book, Look For It, early next year, is The Other Population Crisis, What Governments Can Do About Falling Birth Rates. Alan Wiseman's new book, just out, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan Wiseman, Stephen Philip Kramer, thank you very much to each of you for being with us this hour. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.